All right, I'd like to call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. Good afternoon, everyone. So the first order of business will be to call the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
Eklund, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner. Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Golden.
Present.
Amath.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Lindhagen.
Present.
Heal.
Present.
Morrison.
Present.
Munson.
Present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam. Ryer.
Present.
Quam, present. Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. So with quorum being present, the next order of business is to approve the minutes of February 16th and February 17th. Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes for February 16th and February 17th.
All right. Thank you. And those are items 2 and 3 that were sent out to you members. So is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, if you would all unmute yourselves briefly. All those in favor of approval of the minutes of February 16th and February 17th, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you very much. So the first bill on our agenda today is House File 79, Representative Wasilewicz, and Representative Wasilewicz is here. And so the chair will move that House File 79 will be to be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy. So Representative Wasilewicz, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, many of you are probably familiar with PFAS. PFAS is a group of man-made chemicals. The full name is perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances. And these are found in a wide range of products that we a lot of us use, carpet, cookware, food packaging, et cetera. And that means that most people have been exposed to PFAS at some point in their lives. The problem with these chemicals is that they are persistent in the environment and in the human body, which means that they don't break down and they can accumulate over time, causing adverse health effects such as low infant birth rates, cancer, and thyroid hormone disruptions. Two common ways that PFAS can enter the human body. One is through consumption of contaminated food and or contaminated drinking water. PFAS chemicals are often used as grease-proofing agents on various types of food packaging. So some examples would be fast food wrappers or pizza boxes, popcorn bags as well. And the issue is that these food packaging can contaminate the food, and then humans consume the food, and then the PFAS shows up in their body. Another way that PFAS can enter the body is through drinking water. We've seen examples of PFAS-contaminated drinking water in a few places across our state. Two examples that come to mind that you may have heard about are the East Metro with 3M and then also in the city of Bemidji. So House File 79 is an attempt to tackle these two issues, one by banning the manufacture, distribution, and sale of food packaging that contains intentionally added PFAS beginning January 1st, 2023. The bill also requires the Department of Health to amend the health risk limit of a specific PFAS called perfluoroalkane sulfonate, so that it does not exceed 0.015 parts per billion. So that is what the bill does, and I know there are a couple of testifiers who are here to speak about the bill as well.
All right. Thank you, Representative Wazlik. So our first testifier that I have on the list is Eileen Weber. Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and committee members. Yes, I'm Eileen Weber. I'm a clinical associate professor at the School of Nursing at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for this opportunity to speak in favor of House File 79. I live in the Southeast Metro area affected by the flume of forever chemicals left in our area's groundwater by 3M's manufacturing processes decades ago. We drank, bathed, laundered, and cooked with Cottage Grove's contaminated water for 15 years. During that time, we were raising our family, and I was pregnant with our youngest child. Our kids are grown, and we now live on property in the area with our own well and septic. While our water now tests negative for PFAS, though positive for atrazine, unfortunately, I will now worry for the rest of my life if any future negative health in our family was caused or exacerbated by the exposure my growing family had for 15 years in Cottage Grove. This is especially because some PFAS build up in the body over time. And as my 64-year-old husband and I eagerly await our turn for a COVID-19 vaccine, the information from the MPCA website that PFAS can cause a reduced immunological response to vaccination worries us more than a little. I believe there is also an equity concern that supports you doing all you can against PFAS on our behalf. There are pockets of poverty in the Southeast Metro where people don't have the means to move out of the flume. For example, in 2019, 11.9% of Newport residents had an income level below the poverty level, which was significantly more than the poverty level of 9% across the entire state. Black people in Newport are those most likely to be in poverty, with 38.6% of them below the poverty level. As with so many environmental health issues, our Black and Brown community members often unfairly suffer more. I'm also a public health nurse and a nurse educator at the University of Minnesota, where we teach health professional students about the precautionary principle. When all we have is reasonable suspicion, the precautionary principle underscores the duty we have in public health to prevent harm, even in the face of uncertainty about the causal link to that harm. It's the principle we uphold in the face of avoidable risk when we say, better safe than sorry. I believe that idea supports you doing all you can now to make us more safe and less sorry. That includes amending the relevant health risk limits and eliminating PFAS from food packaging, and I might add, considering the removal of the intent loophole in House File Section 1, House File 79, Section 1, Subdivision 2. Thank you for the work you do and for listening to my testimony.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Weber. If you could stay around in case there are questions, that would be great. And we have Tony Quillis from the Chamber of Commerce. Welcome.
Afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to make a couple of comments on House File 79. First of all, Madam Chair, no other state in the nation has as restrictions that are going to be set forth in House File 79 in regards to food packaging. Three other states have passed laws, but they're all different than what's required in House File 79. New York is the most recent one that passed theirs, but they are only on plant-based fibers, and they don't have the packaging component definition that's included in House File 79. Washington passed theirs in 2018, but again, it's only on fiber-based products and requires their environmental agencies to do a safer alternatives assessment, evaluate those alternatives, and then follow Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse guidelines in evaluating the performance, cost, and availability of those alternatives. They also created a stakeholder group for all interested parties to provide information to their environmental agencies. And then finally, Madam Chair, Maine also asked their environmental agencies to look at safer alternatives make sure that they're readily available, of sufficient quantity, of affordable cost. And then they have a provision that it only applies to companies that have $1 billion and over in national sales. So there are unique differences in those that are not contained in House File 79. There's also an effective date, Madam Chair, but that's going to be better addressed, I think, in the Commerce Committee. But what I want to draw your attention to is Section 2. That allows the legislature, Madam Chair, in statute, to start setting health risk limits in this specific instance for PFOS. I think that is a very dangerous precedent to be set. There is a process under Chapter 14 that allows state agencies, and in this case, the Department of Health, to go through and set up their rulemaking process. And in that rulemaking process, that it's publication in the state register, a statement of need and reasonableness. There's an intent to publish the rules in the state register. There's a 30-day public comment period, possibly an appearance before an administrative law judge. And then the governor's office has 14 days to review the rules when the agency's done. That provides all kinds of public input on this, on whether or not you want to go through and set health risk limits. But for the legislature to go through and start doing this in statute, Madam Chair, I think it's just it's a really dangerous precedent to start. I think there's a process in place that allows public input, and I think we should follow it. And specifically, Madam Chair, also in there, it references Minnesota Statute 144-0751, which is the health standards for drinking water and air quality standards. And it says that those standards should be scientifically acceptable and peer-reviewed. And peer-reviewed means individuals that have substantial knowledge and experience in toxicology, health risk assessment, and other fields as determined by the commissioner. And I'm not sure that 0.015 parts per billion for PFOS has been scientifically acceptable or peer-reviewed. So that's just really concerning, Madam Chair, that the legislature is going to start dictating health risk limits in statute. I can't stress enough how dangerous I think that is for us to start that. And I'll stick around for questions, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to express my comments on House File 79.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Quillis. And I just have a brief comment. You mentioned that some other states apply this to fiber-based products. Could you just explain what the significance of, I don't know what is referred to there. What are fiber-based and why is that a different issue?
Under the definitions, Madam Chair, Subdivision 1, this will include the packaging components, so blocking, bracing, cushioning, inks, labels, shipping containers, where fiber-based means we're just going to be talking about paper-based products.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. I see there's a question from Representative Munson and also Representative Wasluck, I think we'll give you a chance to respond, but let's take some questions first. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question would be for Mr. Quillis. What you mentioned that no other states restrict this chemical, so a big concern would be how many products would not be able to be sold in Minnesota if this were to go into effect. Can you maybe shed some light on how much of the supply chain this would impact for especially for food packaging? And then is there an readily available alternative that would be substituted for this? I'm assuming that this product was applied to the packaging to really to protect the food from going bad or serving some other purpose. But is there another chemical or thing that would be able to be substituted?
Mr. Quillis.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, no other state has actually implemented this because, as I pointed out, in Maine and Washington, their environmental agencies are still trying to address the questions that you just asked of whether or not there's sufficient quantity, comparable cost, whether or not there is alternatives right now. The industry is also on, not to get technical, but the industry has also reached an agreement on short chain PFAS to phase it all out by 2024. So I just wanted to point that out too. But to address your question, Representative Munson, they're working, the industry's working on it, but in terms of the number of products, I can't comment on that.
Yeah, and if I could, Mr. Quillis, too, before I call on the next members, we've got some other hands up, and to all the members, because this is going to commerce. So questions about, you know, the commerce part of this really should be saved for that. This is the Health Committee, so I would just ask members to keep our conversation here on the health aspects of the bill. So Representative Grunhagen, and then Damuth, and then Ryer.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Representative Wazalowicz. You know, I find the testimony from the from Mr. Quillis in the chamber quite concerning. Here we have DHS who has authority to address this, and now we're expanding it to the legislature, according to his testimony. Why are we doing this, and what's your response to the concerns that he's raised?
And Representative Grunhagen, before she responds, I would just say, first of all, we're talking about the health department, not DHS. But also just as members may know, rulemaking that agencies do is essentially a grant from the legislature, that the legislature has the authority to set these kinds of rules, if you will. And we agencies don't unless we give it to them and set the parameters for that. So in terms of authority to do this, now the propriety may be a different thing, but the authority to do this absolutely rests with the legislature. So with that, Representative Wazalowicz, if you can address the question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Grunhagen. So to a, not sure specifically the level is actually based on the health-based value, and that was set for this specific chemical in 2020. So the idea that there's no science behind this just isn't true. There's a health-based value that exists for this chemical already, and it is set at that level that we have specifically in the legislation. And so we're wanting to see that we don't go backwards from that. There was a lot of work done on establishing that health-based value. And we want to make sure that we don't go backwards from where that health-based value has been set, knowing that that was done recently and that it hasn't been that long since then. And also knowing that the health risk level for this specific chemical hasn't been changed since 2009. So sort of seeing the urgency and getting this done and wanting to make sure that we're protecting the health.
Thank you. Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill's author, Representative Wazalowicz, thank you so much for bringing this forward. Just a couple of basic questions. Starting with line 1.14, it looks like the packaging definitions are written very broadly. My question is, why would it make more sense to focus on the packaging that actually comes into contact with the food?
Representative Wazalowicz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Damuth, for the question. Yes, and I'm certainly open. We wanted to start the conversation with a broader definition to make sure that we weren't missing anything. And as we've heard feedback from folks, including you know what Tony Quillis from the Chamber has said and what other legislatures across the country are doing, we certainly can narrow that language down. And I think it makes more sense to have it direct contact with the food, but we wanted to make sure in the initial conversations, we weren't missing anything that might have an impact on that transference to the food items.
Okay. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Wazalowicz, for bringing this forward. I want to center back on the health risks that we're talking about and just have a better sense of the scope and the impact. From what I understand, once these chemicals are in the environment or in our bodies, they are there for keeps and will continue to have the effect. So the sooner we can stop them from spreading further, the better off we are. But what's the prevalence? I mean, so of health issues that relate to it, I'd just like to understand the risk because I am fully supportive of managing it, and I think it's just helpful to know what we're talking about.
Representative Wazalowicz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ryer, for the question. I don't know those numbers off the top of my head. I know that there's still this sort of research into health concerns with PFAS is relatively recent in terms of how research is done and how long that takes and that sort of thing. So I don't have numbers off the top of my head, but I can certainly sort of follow up. And I think another point on that is that with a lot of these things, there's not the ability to draw a 100% direct connection from PFAS to a health condition. So it's certainly possible that somebody who has exposure to PFAS, who has cancer or a thyroid condition, could have gotten it because of exposure to PFAS, but it's also possible that there's a genetic component or other environmental toxins or other things going on that could cause those conditions. So I don't know that we can, as with most sorts of chemicals, I don't know that we can definitively say, you know, this many people have been sickened from PFAS, but we do know that that it does have impacts on health.
Yeah, thank you. And that's, we have Jim Kelly here from the Department of Health. So, Mr. Kelly, if you can, if you have a comment in addition, it would be helpful.
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Kelly. I'm with the Environmental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. PFAS, as Representative Wozlawick has described, is a broad family of chemicals. But there are certainly certain health concerns that have been associated with exposure to PFAS in both animal studies, as well as suggestions of health effects in human epidemiological studies that we've been following and are in fact the basis of the health risk limits and health-based values that we've established for some members of this chemical family. The concerns have to do with potential effects on the immune system, potential effects on the development of a developing fetus in terms of birth weight or other types of issues. There's a few members of the chemical family that have been associated with several different types of cancer, as well as other effects on the liver and kidneys and other functions of the body. So they're relatively new in terms of being a class of contaminants, but they have studies have suggested that there is a concern over exposure to people in these chemicals and from sources in the environment.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Kelly. All right. Representative Wozlawick, final word before we vote on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing the bill today and for the good discussion. I am happy to sort of take the feedback that we've gotten here in the bill is going at least one other stop, so we'll be willing to work with people on this, but appreciate the time. PFAS is a really, you know, we've learned a lot about it in the past several years, and we know that it's a pretty terrible chemical, and we want to do what we can to sort of address the health impacts by preventing it from getting into the human body and accumulating there and causing these adverse health impacts. So thank you for the opportunity, and I will leave it at that.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Wozlawick. So I will renew my motion on behalf of Representative Wozlawick that House File 79 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy. So with that, Ms. Niedernhofer will take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, no.
Ackland, no. Representative Backer.
Backer, no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Damuth, no.
Damuth, no. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grünhagen.
Grünhagen, no.
Grünhagen, no. Representative Kiel.
Kiel, no.
Kiel, no. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam, no. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Madam Chair, 11 ayes and 8 nays.
All right, there being 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to Commerce. Thank you, Representative Wasilewicz and testifiers. So the next bill on our agenda today is House File 801, Representative Morrison, who's on the committee. So Representative Morrison will move that House File 801 be recommended to be re-referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, I'm pleased to present House File 801, which would establish a prescription drug affordability board to give the state the ability to limit how much residents must pay for certain high-cost drugs. The costs of prescription drugs continue to skyrocket in the United States, even during a global pandemic, making it difficult for Minnesotans to afford their prescriptions. Unless we do more to keep costs down, more people will not be able to afford their drugs, leading to poorer health outcomes and higher healthcare costs. As a doctor, I regularly see patients struggle to afford the drugs they need. Drugs don't work if people can't access them because they can't afford them. By addressing the high cost of drugs, we can also lower the high costs of healthcare and health insurance. This proposal was one of the top strategies of the Blue Ribbon Commission charged with finding savings in the state budget and the Attorney General's bipartisan prescription drug task force. This legislation is based on a National Academy of State policy model. Most recently, Maryland, Maine, and New York have passed into law and established prescription drug affordability boards. None of us is immune to the effects of the high cost of prescription drugs. It impacts all of us. Let me share some of the recent examples of skyrocketing drug prices. The cost of Bavencio, for example, a cancer drug approved several years ago, is about $156,000 a year per patient. A new muscular dystrophy drug recently came on the market for an eye-popping price of $300,000 annually. In 2016, the FDA approved a medication to treat bladder cancer. Its cost, $12,500 a month or $150,000 a year. Even older drugs that have been on the market are not immune. We know the cost of insulin has tripled despite no notable changes in the formulation. And the four-decade-old EpiPen, a life-saving allergy medication, has seen its price rise by 500% since 2007. Clearly, more has to be done to address the high cost of prescription drugs. A prescription drug affordability board is one way we can take action to do so. Let me share just a brief overview of the bill. The bill establishes a 7-member board whose members are appointed by the governor and the House and Senate and have relevant experience in drug pricing and no conflicts of interest. The bill also establishes a 12-member advisory council to provide advice to the board, since drug costs involve many complicated issues and affect numerous stakeholders. The advisory council includes drug manufacturers, employers, health plan companies, providers, researchers, advocates, and state government. The board will be an independent body with statewide authority to evaluate high drug costs and set an upper payment limit if a drug's cost is excessive and prevents an affordability challenge for the state's health system or for patients. The overarching goal of a prescription drug affordability board is to find the upper payment limit at which insurers, purchasers, and government programs can afford to provide the drug to everyone in the state who needs to get it. The point is to expand sales and patient access, not to reduce manufacturer revenue. In determining which drugs to review, the board could consider drugs that reach certain thresholds under the law or pose an affordability challenge. This legislation builds off of the drug price transparency law that was passed last year. Once the decision is made for the board to review a particular drug, the board can consider a number of factors in making its decision to set an upper payment limit, including rebates by the manufacturers, average co-pays, and cost-sharing pay, and cost-sharing that patients pay, and other factors. And finally, the bill does establish an appeals process for persons impacted by the board's decision and remedies through the Attorney General's office. And it requires the board to report to the governor and the legislature annually about the number of drugs subject to cost review and analysis. The idea of an affordability board is based on two longstanding precedents of healthcare rate setting and public service commissions. States regulate insurers and other public goods such as gas, electric, and telecommunications in markets with little or no market competition. And determining upper payment levels for healthcare and other public goods is a state practice that has existed for decades. Upper payment limits also build on the standard operating procedures of the existing supply chain, where manufacturers routinely adjust their price concessions through negotiations with providers or the supply chain when payer reimbursement does not cover the product list price. And Madam Chair, I believe I have three testifiers today.
Okay, we're ready to go to testifiers. Thank you, Representative Morrison. So we have at least one testifier who's probably not yours, but we have the first person on my list is Kate Bone, if I'm saying that correctly. Welcome. And you're on mute. And if you would first just tell us your name and if you're representing anyone, and then please go ahead and give us your testimony.
My name is Catherine Bond. I was just kind of made aware that there was a testifying today. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Bond. I'm a married mother with two sons from Minneapolis. All three of us have severe allergies to bees, peanuts, and mold. We are supposed to carry EpiPens on us just in case of anaphylactic reactions, life-threatening issues where your throat closes up and you stop breathing and die within minutes. Despite the fact that EpiPens only cost about $3 to make and have been around since 1987, each EpiPen pack costs about $1,500 out of pocket with private insurance. Years ago, I only paid about $30. I've had to choose which son deserves his life saved more because we couldn't afford $4,500 for all three of us to carry the life-saving injector. Imagine having to make this choice. It's wrong. Drugs don't work if people can't afford them. Big Pharma wrote the rules this way, and it's time to change them. Minnesota needs a prescription drug affordability board. I urge you to vote yes on this life-saving bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Ms. Bond. Appreciate that. And I also have allergy to bee stings, so I know wherein you speak about how quickly this can go into a life-threatening event. And, of course, with multiple allergies, it is that much worse. Ramey Hamron, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for having me here to share my story today. My name is Ramey Hamron. I'm a proud resident of Bemidji, Minnesota. I'm a single mom with three children, including two daughters in college. In 2018, I was diagnosed with an incurable blood cancer called multiple myeloma. Before my diagnosis, I was a high school math teacher and a long distance runner. Now I can no longer do either. I had to take a leave of absence from my job as a teacher to undergo several surgeries, radiation, an induction chemotherapy regimen, and a stem cell transplant. My slow recovery from the transplant, coupled with the intense fatigue from my daily maintenance regimen, has prevented me from returning to work. I have just enough energy to take care of myself and my son. Currently, I rely on a daily oral chemotherapy drug called Revlimid to keep me alive. This drug is priced at over $250,000 per year. When I was initially diagnosed, I relied on grants from the manufacturer that covered my share of the costs. I was incredibly grateful for the financial help, but now that I'm on Medicare, that assistance has evaporated. My out-of-pocket costs are now around $15,000 a year. This amount is impossible for me to cover on my fixed income. In order to continue taking this life-saving drug, there's a chance I will have to deplete my life savings, cash out my 401k, and sell my house. When those funds run out, I'm not sure what I'll do. Usually I'm a planner, but I cannot plan for this. While my disease is unique, my situation is not. Countless life-sustaining medications are priced out of reach for families all across our state. My circumstances make me feel helpless at times, but I'm grateful that I can share my story with all of you. This bill to create a drug pricing board is an essential first step to hold drug companies accountable and fix this broken system. Drugs don't work if people can't afford them. I strongly urge you to vote yes on House File 801 to protect patients from the burden of high drug prices. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for joining us, Ms. Hamrin. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The next person on my list is Peter Fielstad from Pharma. Mr. Fielstad, sir, if I'm saying your name wrong, please go ahead.
No, thank you, Chair Liebling. That's it. Said it exactly correct. Thank you, Chair Liebling, and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Peter Fielstad. I'm a senior director of state policy for Pharma. We're the trade association for 33 biopharmaceutical manufacturers that make brand name medicines to save and improve lives for patients every day. Over half of our member companies are working to make treatments or vaccines for COVID-19 with 15 clinical trials for COVID treatments and vaccines going on right now in the state of Minnesota. Today, I respectfully oppose Representative Morrison's House File 801 for the following reasons. It imposes a harmful price control through an upper payment limit, which could restrict patient access to their medicines and discourage the research and development, or R&D, of new treatments and cures. Second, it fails to consider the real problem regarding the cost of prescription drugs, which is the health plan benefit design. Third, it does not take into account the growth rate of prescription drugs, which has slowed in recent years, only rising 1.7% in 2019, which is below the rate of inflation. Fourth, it does not recognize that price controls on brand medicines raise significant legal concerns. Next, it raises additional legal concerns under both federal and state law related to potential disclosure of trade secret information, specifically by allowing the Prescription Drug Affordability Board created in this bill to determine what information they believe qualifies as proprietary. It would also establish a new level of bureaucracy on top of last year's prescription drug price transparency bill, which doesn't even collect the designated information from manufacturers until October 1st of 2021. Or a little between 7 and 8 months from now, for a report that's finally due to the legislature in January of 2022 after MDH has digested and analyzed the information. Lastly, it may harm Minnesota's economy during this ongoing pandemic. I'd like to direct you to the Medicine Assistance Tool, which contains over 950 patient assistance programs to help patients become eligible for subsidies for their payment assistance for their medications should they not be able to afford them. That's mat.org. I stand for any questions, and I appreciate you taking the time to hear from me today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that. And we have Tony Bangskow. Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with members. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Tony K. Manskow, and I'm a constituent from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 801. I am a social worker and currently work in cancer research. I know the importance of patients having access to newer cancer treatments with a more targeted approach in attacking cancer. Many of these newer treatments are in pill form, which may eliminate the need for accessing care in a hospital setting. My mom was diagnosed with a rare type of blood cancer in 2012. This is the same type of cancer her mom died of in the 1980s. My brother and I have been diagnosed with a precancerous blood disease that can progress to cancer. I worry about my mom's current medical needs and my brother and my future needs, including access to some of these newer medications. In the past, my mom had to be hospitalized for her cancer treatments. The physical toll the treatments took on her reached a point of not knowing each time if she'd be able to rebound and recover from the effects the intravenous targeted therapy and older chemotherapy had on her body. During the time our family was struggling with making a decision on having more of this type of treatment, a new oral targeted therapy was approved for use in my mom's type of cancer. Our family felt like we could breathe again. We were, for the moment, relieved. My mom made the decision to start on the oral medication known as ibrutinib, or the brand name Imbruvica. My mom had Medicare as her primary, United Health as her secondary, and a Medicare Part D prescription drug plan. She started on ibrutinib in August 2016, and the drug cost $11,500 per month, or $138,000 per year. Even with my social work and cancer research background, I was shocked at how much my mom's monthly out-of-pocket costs would be, but this medication would probably give her a better quality of life and more time with family. My mom's copayment for ibrutinib would be $680 per month, almost half of her Social Security benefits of $1,550. We were determined to find a way to make things work. Luckily, I knew staff from the American Cancer Society that helped me find a grant to help cover some of the out-of-pocket costs. Unfortunately, there reached a time where one grant didn't cover the cost, and we needed to seek a second grant. Our family has been fortunate to be able to find grants that have covered her out-of-pocket prescription costs. My mom has had a very good response to the medication ibrutinib. There's no doubt in my mind this medication has given her extra years of quality time with family. Without these grants, my mom would not have been able to afford the medication. Other families may not be so lucky, as the grants may run out throughout the year and enrollment can close at any time. Many other people don't know where to start to find this type of resource. Like the prices of everything, drug prices continue to rise while incomes, including my mom's, don't rise. This past year, my mom has had to spend down any assets to get on a government program to assist with costs related to medications and her assisted living facility. At this time, she has no copay. Currently, the ibrutinib is $13,366 per month, or what amounts to $160,392 per year. I don't know what the future will bring for my mom, brother, and I. This past spring, I learned not only that I had the precancerous blood condition that can transform to my mom's type of cancer, but I also received confirmation I carry the genetic mutation. I am a mother and grandmother, and there's so much unknown for what this means for my kids and grandkids. Working in cancer research, I know my family's story is not unique. There is some amazing medical research underway in Minnesota. Let's make sure all residents have access to the medications that we need. Because if you can't afford the medication, it won't work. Please pass House File 801. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Mankskow. We appreciate that. And our final testifier is Jessica Intermill. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Intermill, and I live in Minneapolis with my husband and my daughter. 9 years ago, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. I was 7 months pregnant, and 22 days after that, I delivered our daughter. I have never been a chronic illness patient without a kid, and she has never had a mother who is entirely healthy. The closest I can come to healthy is to inject myself with this medication, Actemra, once every 2 weeks. Now, it's not a cure. There is no cure for rheumatoid arthritis, but it stops my body from eating holes the size of buckshot into my bones. It allows me to be a mom, a wife, a citizen, a small business owner, a person who people in our community can depend on. And it costs $56,000 per year, every year. That's $150 per day, which is $25 per day more than when I testified in favor of this bill last year. Now, I'm enormously grateful for the life that this medication gives me, and it will easily exceed my ability to pay at some point if this committee does not take action. Now, we've heard that the bill will hurt patients by making this market anti-competitive, but there already is no competition in the name brand drug market. There is not a single other manufacturer who makes this drug. So why wouldn't it price gouge? I can't go anywhere else. If I don't purchase this drug, my body will start eating holes in itself again, and inflammation will attack every one of my organs. Patients can't say no to the drugs that we need. I can't say no to a drug that costs four times as much as my mortgage. But you can say no. You can, and I urge your support of House File 801 and your passage so that we can have some real common sense controls of this out of control pricing. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Before we go to the questions, because we do have a lot of questions, I neglected to ask Representative Morrison if you wanted to move the A2 amendment, which I think we have. Did you want to do that?
I would like to move the A2 amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. So, Representative Morrison, could you just describe what the A2 does?
Madam Chair, members, the A2 is a clarification about conflicts of interest for members of the Affordability Board.
Okay. So are there, it's kind of awkward when we have all these hands up already, but are there questions to the amendment? If you would just like wave your hand or something if you have a question to the amendment. I'm not seeing any. So let's just adopt the amendment to put the bill in the order in which the author would like to have it. So if members would just unmute yourselves for a moment. All those in favor of adopting the A2, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Thank you, members, for that. So I have a long list here, and I'll just tell you who's on the list so everybody kind of knows what to expect here, and we have quite a few. So it's Munson, Schultz, Grunhagen, Bierman, Quam, Bonner. So if you would all, we're going to get through this. We have one other bill today. So if you would please, if we can keep the questions and the answers brief, that would be helpful. So Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Morrison. I appreciate the discussion that will come forward in this bill. I've been on the Health Committee since, all three terms that I've been elected, and I continue to learn about how complex the pharmaceutical supply chain is and how this has really either prevented patients' access to affordable care or protected the pricing and the markups and the kickbacks in this industry, and it's very frustrating to see. One of my fears is growing the amount of regulation or empowering government to set prices, because that will only fuel the pharmaceutical companies from getting involved in elections and basically buying government. And that's a fear that I have. I think we all want the same thing. We want lower costs, but I feel like the way to do that is to empower the consumer as opposed to empowering government. So that is the basis of my objection to this bill, because I think we're creating something where we can set the prices for something that the pharmaceutical industries will get more involved in government. We're going the wrong way. So for that reason, I just would ask, my question to you is, do you see this bill as increasing the pharmaceutical company's involvement in politics more than it is today?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Munson. That's a really interesting question and an interesting point, and brings up another issue that I think we really need to tackle, which is campaign finance reform. So let's team up on that offline, but that's not probably part of the Health Committee conversation. First, I just want to level set that this is not setting prices. This is an upper payment limit. The manufacturer can set whatever price it determines. So my hope is that this would not involve the pharmaceutical industry more in politics. That is the opposite of what I want to see happen. What I want to see happen is that Minnesotans can access the medications that they need to survive and to thrive. I mean, it's that simple. I think we need sort of a mind shift about how we approach prescription drugs. Prescription drugs are a public good. You know, we make sure that people can turn on the heat in the winter, because we know that they can die if they don't have adequate heat in our Minnesota winters. If you need insulin, if you need an EpiPen, if you need any number of the drugs that we've heard about and so many others, and you can't afford them, that's not okay. It's immoral in my mind. So we need to think about prescription medications as a public good, and the state has an interest in making sure that its residents have access to the medications that they need to survive. So thank you for the question, and Representative Munson, I look forward to talking about campaign finance reform with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morrison, and I would just say, interesting question. Yeah, the pharmaceutical industry has been deeply involved in politics at the federal level probably for decades, and our whole patent system and probably some of the concerns that we have and the way this has been able to grow out of control are probably because of the control that the pharmaceutical industry has at the federal level. So, but interesting comment. Representative Schultz. So I've got Schultz, Grünhagen, Bierman, Quam, Bonner, and Auckland, and I think that's as much as we're going to be able to take on this bill, and we're going to try to vote after that. So Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I just want to make a point in response to the testifier from the pharmaceutical industry. So there is no research, academic research. In fact, academic research shows that there's no correlation between prices and innovation. So I am not concerned at all that this would limit innovation and developing new drugs. In fact, since 1975, only 10 to 15% of the drugs entering the market were considered advances. So most of the drug drugs being introduced are existing drugs or similar to existing drugs called me-too drugs. And second, you know, pharmaceutical companies have the highest profit margin, more than three times most S&P 500 companies. And they spend about, we spend about 20% of our healthcare spending on drugs, but pharmaceutical companies get about 63% of the profits in all of the healthcare industry. And they spend over $180 billion a year on marketing and advertising and sales and lobbying. So there's significant profit and significant spending on other things besides innovation. And lastly, you know, it's the government and academic institutions that are actually doing a lot of the bench science, the R&D, and not pharmaceutical companies. And a perfect example is how much of the research on RNA and DNA vaccinations development for infectious diseases not being done by pharmaceutical companies. In fact, I think they have only done about 1% of spending on R&D for infectious diseases. The rest is coming through the government or R1 academic institutions. So I'm very supportive of this bill. I just want to thank Representative Morrison for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Grünhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I certainly empathize with the people that, as far as the cost of drugs, I've sold health insurance since 1978. In the last few years, especially, I've had people crying in my office because they can't afford the prescription drugs. It seems, though, I have an independent pharmacist who says things got much worse when Obamacare was passed. And as in terms of allowing the PBMs and other parts of the distribution chain of drugs to run wild. We've had testimony in the past in this committee about the PBMs and other things. Some of that, I think, has to be federal. My problem with more government is that when I see all the promises of government, like Obamacare and other things, it seems like, you know, we're going to call this the Affordability Advisory Council. Well, I think we'd be better off calling it the Prescription Drug Shortage and Unaffordability Advisory Council, because 9 times out of 10, what government claims, just the opposite happens. So that's my concern. But my question is for Mr. Fjeldstad and Farmer, okay? Mr. Fjeldstad, you said that there were 950 programs available. You heard the testimony of these people hurting. I've talked to people in the same situation. It's a travesty. It needs to be fixed. I don't believe this bill will actually do that. I actually identify with some of the things you've raised as concern. But what do you say to these people who are desperately need these drugs? And is there programs for them? Are they accessing them? And what's your response to their concerns?
Mr. Fjeldstad.
Chair Liebling, Representative Grünhagen. Yeah, certainly regarding the 950 patient assistance programs, those are a litany of programs by just about every manufacturing member. We represent 33 brand name manufacturers to help patients afford their drugs. Beyond that, I would directly answer back that in each individual circumstance, the unaffordability of drugs has primarily to do with the health plan benefit design for that individual, and I would take that on an individual basis, and hopefully that answers your question.
All right.
Madam Chair, I suppose you want to move on, right?
Yeah, I do, Representative Grünhagen. Real quickly.
Well, I was just to say, the people who are hurting like this, why don't you get in touch with Mr. Fieldsad and see what he can do to help point you in the right direction. I think it was mat.org, if I wrote it down wrong. But you definitely need some help. And generally, when I've worked with people who have come into my office who can't afford their drugs, we have been able to call Senior Linkage or some organization like that and match up some subsidies for that particular drug so they can afford it. However, I do agree, long-term reform needs to happen. I don't believe this bill is going to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. So, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and a lot of comments here already. I'm having a hard time now which ones to respond to, but it's a lot to talk about, and I think we've touching on a lot of parts. So first, I would just like to thank Representative Morrison for bringing this bill forward. As the number one recommendation of the Attorney General's task force, this affordability commission is but one step on what we need to do as a body to address the high cost of pharmaceuticals, which affects not only all of your constituents, but all of us here at the table. These high drug costs come back to us in the form of higher insurance premiums. And so it's such a cost driver that it is smart to be doing this one first, and this committee, this commission is essential. So I would just say to the committee members, any of you who truly want to do anything about the high cost of healthcare, start here. Vote for this commission. Members, the pharmaceutical market is not a normal market by any way, shape, or means, and it's not something that we can go back and make normal. And we really need to do, as Representative Morrison said, think about drugs as a public good, a public utility, if you will, and that's more of how we should be approaching this. Because the market cannot be fixed, as was pointed out, the influence in politics and in the federal government, that is essentially why we are here talking about this bill today in the State House and in other state houses around the country. So the market can't correct when there's such an advantage for pharmaceuticals in research, whether it's government or universities or in the markets where they have a ready-made market for Medicare with pricing that can't be negotiated, or in the courts of law with the patent thickets that they have to protect their pricing and their markets. So it's essentially a stymieing competition that protects their advantage. So that's all I wanted to say, just a statement. But members, start here. This is where we begin to have an impact, and vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and a member of my household has MS. I'm very familiar with medications that cost thousands of dollars a month and some of the programs that offset that. I'm also familiar with the fact that several years ago, medication costs overtook hospitalization as the major cost driver in healthcare, and that for in Minnesota, individuals with insurance, they have over 100 million pharmacy claims a year, and it's over 10 billion. So it's a huge factor. I understand the intent of this bill. I think there might be some concerns that have been brought up about accessibility if we're a state that has price controls in the states around us. I'd hope the author would look at another thing to include would be, you know, the fact that 90% of individuals carry one or more genetic differences that affects what medications work and how people metabolize those, and that half the people have five or more genetic differences, and that by doing PGX, we could actually cut the cost by not prescribing stuff that doesn't work and do it faster. So when you have the final form of the bill if you've got a board and one of the things they're looking at is utilization of, and the test if you come off the street is less than $350, but unless if you do it in groups, utilization of PGX as a cost containment and a saving, plus getting people the right medication right away, as opposed to, you know, the third medication they find out is the one that'll work. So if the author has looked at this or is interested in looking at that, I'd like to know, and we'll work with her in the interim. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Kwan. Perhaps you can talk about that with her offline. That would be fine. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Morrison. I won't go into a few things that have already been covered by some of my colleagues here today, but I just wanted to say, you know, this is the reality on the ground. About 19 million people in the U.S. are going outside of the country to get their drugs. That's about 8% of the U.S. population. We have other countries where we're selling the exact same drugs, and they are paying 56% less than we are in the U.S. You know, we talk about things like competition, but here in the U.S., the system is rigged. If you don't want to have competition, you buy up your competitor that has a promising drug and you shelf it so that it can't compete with your own, so you can charge whatever you want as long as you want. That's the reality on the ground. We talked about restricting access, you know, and there's 950 programs to do that. Well, here's a crazy thought. I don't know about you, but my 85-year-old grandmother cannot sift through 950 programs. That is unrealistic and ridiculous to ask families to do that. When here's a very simple solution. Here in the U.S., we can actually have some sort of measure to make sure that we actually have pricing that is reasonable and affordable and in line with what other countries pay, especially when you consider that a lot of those innovations are coming out of our own country. Why would we charge someone, you know, 56% more outside of the country or inside of the country than we do others just because we can? That is never the right thing to do. We have people rationing their drugs because they can't afford them. You know, we need to get to a place where we're talking about how we make prices affordable for real families. And really, if the industry can't police itself, I mean, I don't want to be in that position either. But realistically, if they can't do it themselves, I think we've been placed into a position where we actually have to act in the best interest of our citizens. And I think that's our job as legislators, to make sure that that happens. And quite frankly, the reason that we're paying certain high prices for drugs, honestly, there is no other good rationale in common sense for why they are so much higher and significantly higher in the U.S. with no competition than other than pure greed. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a sort of a clarification and a question probably for Mr. Feelstead. I think Representative Kwan quoted that our cost of prescription drugs has exceeded our cost of hospitalizations. I hope I got that right. And I've heard that before. Dr. Morrison gave several examples of how there have been significant price increases, like the increase of EpiPens and insulin, and that is hard to understand. I don't know why that is so, but that's not part of the question. But then we have these extreme outliers, these drugs that cost $250,000 a year, drugs that cost $300,000 a year. And so I'm trying to tie a lot of this together, and I know this is true. My mother had her own drug that was $10,000 a month, so $120,000 a year. So I know this is true, but when I think about this, how these drug costs have exceeded the hospitalization costs, I'm wondering if this is what's driving it up, if we're talking about these drugs that cost $250,000 and $300,000 a year, or are we talking about just the normal drugs people take on a day-to-day basis? So my question to Mr. Fjellstad is this. You mentioned somewhere in your list of four or five bullet points that you made. Thought I caught just a little bit of a glimpse of a question, of a point that you were going to make, that at some point, if we do some price controls, especially on these really expensive drugs, is there a chance that those drugs really would not be available, that the pharmaceutical companies wouldn't be able to provide those at a price that what would be considered affordable? Because honestly, $250,000 is not affordable for, I would say, 99% of the people in the United States, but also $100,000 isn't going to be affordable. For most of us, $30,000 wouldn't be affordable. So for me, I'm just asking this question, at what point when we talk about affordable, does that say, you know what, then these drugs wouldn't be available for us?
Mr. Fjellstad?
Oops. Chair Liebling, Representative Ackland, I'm going to try to answer the question as best I can. I believe you're referring to the point that I made about the upper payment limit, which is a price control as contained in the bill. How would that restrict patient access? And then what is driving the overall costs of drugs? First, I'm going to go to the second point first. Regarding the overall cost of drugs taking over hospital care, I'd need to see that report. I haven't seen it, but I'm happy to take a look at it. And secondly, regarding patient access to certain drugs, you know, when we've seen price controls established, whether it be in Canada or any other country, we've seen the patient access to existing and new treatments severely limited. And I think we can point to Canada specifically as an example. And there, generics are actually more expensive than they are in the United States. So there's a lot of different things at play. And I'm just going to loop back to the fact that the pharmaceutical supply chain in the United States has about six or seven actors, with each of those taking a piece out of the rebates that we pay back to bring down the cost of drugs for patients. And that's why I think any of these patients, especially those in the high cost situations, might be realizing those costs out of their pocket.
All right. Thank you. We're going to go now to Representative Morrison for final word on the bill, and then we will be voting on the bill. So, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I first want to thank our testifiers, Catherine and Ramey and Tony Kay and Jessica, for speaking about their very personal experiences and healthcare journeys. It's very difficult and very brave to talk about such personal things in a public forum, and I'm very grateful to them for doing that for all Minnesotans, ultimately. And I want to thank members for a productive conversation. A lot of important and different points were made, and I think that for everyone who's listening, you already knew this, but we demonstrated today that this is not a partisan issue. This impacts everyone in our state, and we need to act. We need to take steps to make the prescription drugs that people need to survive and thrive affordable. And this is an exciting first step to make that reality in Minnesota. So I appreciate the conversation. Thank you very much. And I urge a yes vote.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison. So Representative Morrison renews her motion that House File 801 as amended be recommended to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. So Ms. Niedernhofer will take the roll on the bill, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lee Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, no.
Ackland, no. Representative Backer.
Backer votes no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
No.
Damuth, no. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, no.
Grinhagen, no. Representative Keel?
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison?
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson?
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor?
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam?
No.
Quam, no. Representative Ryer?
Aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott?
Aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Madam Chair, 11 ayes and 8 nays.
All right, there being 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to judiciary. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison and testifiers. The next bill on our agenda is House File 894. Representative Bernardi is here, I hope, to present that bill. There she is. Welcome. And since
Thank
she's
you.
Not on our committee, the chair will move that House File 894 be laid over for possible inclusion in our finance bill. So, Representative Bernardi, please tell us about your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members, for this opportunity to present my this bill today. I don't think it was my bill. I think it is a bill for Minnesotans and the people who need it most. People with a chronic disease do better with treatment than without. I think we all can agree with that. Legislating restrictions on medical care actually seems immoral, especially when people who experience being overweight and obese affects two-thirds of us. And especially affects people in Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities disproportionately. This effort or bill is to get rid of legislation discrimination. The accumulation of excess fat mass leads to a myriad of physical, metabolic, and psychological changes. It takes away the health of individuals. There is now universal agreement that obesity is a chronic disease and that it should be treated like any other chronic disease. As in the case with diabetes, hypertension, AIDS, heart failure, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, and other lifelong diseases, obesity can be managed, treated, or controlled. In addition to its serious health consequences, obesity has economic costs that affect all of us. The estimated annual health costs of obesity-related illness has been projected as much as $190 billion, or nearly 20% of medical spending in the U.S. The cost to the state of Minnesota for all obesity-related medical complication includes costs for diabetes, with all of its complications, hypertension, high cholesterol, vascular disease, coronary artery disease, sleep apnea, many cancers, degenerative arthritis, including joint replacements, stroke, infertility, and many others. Weight loss reduces lifetime health care costs. It makes both scientific sense and fiscal sense for Minnesota to mainstream the treatment of obesity. Medications for weight loss must be an option for every patient who are overweight or obese. There are medications that are approved by the Food and Drug Administration to treat overweight or obesity for the long term. The treatment of patients who are overweight and obese is the foundation of treatment is eating healthy, behavior modifications to develop a healthier, more active lifestyle. It's a focus different than diet and exercise. Medications help patients achieve treatment goals. The benchmark for treatment of overweight or obesity, I'm told by medical doctors, is to achieve and maintain at least a 5 to 10% weight loss from baseline. The weight loss has demonstrable improvements in physical, metabolic, and psychological health. Medication plays a major role in helping to maintain the lost weight and allowing for further weight loss. Modifying the statute that I bring before you today is a very important step in Minnesota, in helping Minnesota in the current treatment of obesity and overweight problems. It will allow many patients access to needed health care and update Minnesota law, which will have positive impact for all of us. With us today, I have Dr. Claudia K. Fox. She is an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics and co-director of the Center for Pediatric Obesity Medicine at the University of Minnesota. She leads the Pediatric Weight Management Clinic, is in the co-director of the Teen Weight Loss Surgery Clinic at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Fox has been working exclusively with weight management patients for the past 14 years and is a board certified by the American Board of Obesity Medicine. In addition to pediatrics, her expertise is in the clinical management of youth and severe obesity in this population. Dr. Fox's research focus has also been on the use of medications for obesity in youth. She has been a co-investigator or principal investigator of several National Institute of Health clinical trials examining medications for the management of obesity in youth. Thank you for being with us today. And Madam Chair, if she could testify, right. I would appreciate
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Bernardi. And just before Dr. Fox begins her testimony, I just want to make sure members understand that obesity drugs, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Bernardi, obesity drugs have been specifically excluded from being covered under Medicaid. And that is the reason why we have to have this bill, because it's important to bring them back under coverage. So Dr. Fox, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, legislators, for your time. I appreciate it. To start, I want to talk about what obesity is and what obesity is not. Obesity is a complex disorder of energy regulation. It's a disease that stems from abnormal biology that is primarily inherited. Obesity is not a problem of willpower. It is not related to poor parenting or laziness. Obesity is no one's fault. It's a disease that needs treatment. And in Minnesota, nearly one out of every 10 children and one out of every three adults suffers from obesity, and its consequences are tremendous. I want to tell you about one of my patients. I'll call him Derek. He's not his real name. I saw him last week for the first time, and he's 14 years old and weighs 270 pounds. And he came to clinic with his dad, who also carries extra weight. And his dad tells me that he really wants a better life for his son because the dad knows very well how hard it is to grow up being the biggest kid in class and always being sort of the butt of jokes. Unfortunately, Dad's a little bit too late because Derek's already been ostracized for years. He's now in ninth grade from his peers, and he suffers from depression and anxiety. And so at that first visit, as part of our workup, we check blood tests, and lo and behold, we identify that he was diagnosed with diabetes. So now we have this 14-year-old boy, a ninth grader, with depression and anxiety, who now has diabetes and is going to need to give himself insulin injections, all because he was born into a family with the disease of obesity. Because he's so young and has diabetes at this age, it's very likely that he's going to end up needing dialysis in about 10 years when he's in his 20s and is probably going to die an early death related to heart disease. Now, when I saw him, I would have liked to start him on weight loss medications to help him lose weight. But because he has the Medicaid state plan, these medications were not even an option for him. So instead, we talked about how we could use non-FDA approved medicines and split pills and try to do all these other strategies to kind of get around the fact that he is on the Medicaid plan. None of this is really going to make a difference. If Derek had private insurance, however, the outlook would have been very different. I would have been able to prescribe weight loss medications. He would have been able to lose some weight, which will directly improve his depression, anxiety, and most certainly his diabetes status. It's not clear why Medicaid should call out obesity as being a disease that doesn't merit the standard of care treatment by not covering medications for weight loss. To me, the only logical reason is that obesity is not viewed as a disease or a medical condition. After all, we would never accept the same differential treatments for other diseases like cancer. So, for example, if you had a patient with cancer, we would never accept that they would have subpar or substandard treatment for if he had Medicaid coverage compared to private insurance. So to me, covering weight loss medications by state Medicaid is really, it's a parity issue. And additionally, we know that obesity does disproportionately affect communities of color. And these are the people who rely on Medicaid. So it's also an equity issue. Now, I am fully aware that covering these medications will cost the state money. However, the cost of not covering these medicines is going to cost the state even more money. The healthcare cost of an adult with obesity is 150% greater than that of an adult without obesity. And these costs stem directly from caring for these obesity-related consequences, diabetes, heart failure, and cancer. So medical assistance coverage of weight loss medication makes good financial sense. It's also the right thing to do in terms of parity and equity and improving the lives of thousands of Minnesotans who are affected by the disease of obesity. And thank you very kindly for your time. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Fox. That's really, really helpful. I wonder, could you just take a moment to tell us about the efficacy of these drugs? I know that they've improved greatly over recent years, and I think there was just one. There was a big study that with some real success. Could you just address that really briefly?
Right. I can for sure. So what's important to recognize is that weight loss doesn't have to be very much to have significant health consequences. So as little as 5% weight loss can result in substantial decline in cardiovascular disease risk and diabetes risk. So we're not talking about big changes. Most of the medications that are available that are FDA approved for obesity can achieve anywhere from 4% now down up to like 18% weight loss, depending on the medication. So yes, you're right. There is a new medicine that was just FDA approved, or a new study that came out that showed that this efficacy is in the teens in percent of weight loss. That one's not yet FDA approved, but it's coming soon. So it really serves as an adjunct to lifestyle therapy. It's not a substitution for lifestyle therapy. It helps people adhere to their healthy diets better by addressing some of that underlying biology that makes people feel abnormally hungry when they shouldn't be feeling so hungry, for example.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your testimony. Are there questions for members? Representative Bonner.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Bernardi for bringing this forward. And actually, I had a couple questions, and I think Dr. Fox actually answered one, and Chair Liebling actually asked the other. So I'll just briefly comment and say, you know, I think I've long been a proponent of preventative medicine, and I think not only is it the right thing to do, but it certainly has the power to ensure that we have better health outcomes for patients and really bring down costs for the state, but more importantly, right, for the family, you know, and it's just the right thing to do to make sure people are healthier, that they have a better quality of life. So I really appreciate you bringing the bill forward. And with that, since my questions were already answered, I will be done, but thank you.
Right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. And, yeah, and just remember a little history. We had this in our omnibus bill last in 2019, but we were unable to fund it in the final bill. We don't have a fiscal note this time, but, you know, and unfortunately our fiscal notes, as you all know, don't capture savings that are, you know, even, and, but once in a while we do get there if the savings are so well known and well described. And I'm just hoping that we can fund the bill this year, and also that, and I know I kind of cued Dr. Fox and Representative Bernardi about this question, but kind of how, as time goes on, how we can really show the impact if there would be, maybe the U is doing research, or maybe we don't even need to, maybe it's already there, to really be able to show the economic savings, because in our budgeting process, that's always a difficult right. issue. Mm-hmm. Dr. Fox?
Mm-hmm. Well, there certainly are studies that look at the cost of obesity on a national level. I don't know of any work that can show the cost on a state level, but it's certainly something that we could look at our School of Public Health to perhaps get us some hard numbers, which may help make the case.
Okay. Well, that's great. And Representative Bernardi?
I wanted to add to that as well. I think an important part to mention is that a metric that would really, really be important is that people with obesity will go from 0% of getting coverage for their obesity medications to more than 50% gaining access to FDA-approved medication for their chronic disease.
Yeah, no, that's
huge.
Great. It's huge, yeah. And so I really appreciate both of you. Dr. Fox, thank you so much for bringing your expertise to us today, and Representative Bernardi. And, you know, it'd be great if we could get our fiscal note people to include the savings so that because then I think we'd see a savings in our spreadsheet. But anyway, we're going to do our very best to start covering this, because it does seem like, you know, there's just, other than the dollars, I don't know why we wouldn't do it. So thank you very much. So with that, House File 894 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So there being no other business before the committee today, I think we've reached the end of our agenda for the day. And tomorrow we're going to have a presentation on the governor's proposal on non-emergency medical transportation, which is a savings proposal, something we need to focus on a little bit in case we have a budget that is a cut budget, actually. And then we're going to hear House File 1268 from Representative Richardson about healthy development of babies. And then we're going to hear a little bit about telemedicine from the Department of Human Services. So with that, members, look forward to seeing you tomorrow, and we are adjourned.